Jacob, Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, quote, leapt over the gulf of generations and transmitted the great Mesorah, or tradition, of Abraham directly to Ephraim and Manasseh. Despite the discrepancy of years, the Zakein, carrier of the old tradition, succeeded. How appropriate, therefore, that our people is called Israel or Jacob, for it was he who created the Jewish community which ensures Jewish continuity. Welcome to Parsha and Politics, Parashat Vayechi, the nation of grandparents and grandchildren. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Parsha and Politics, How Torah Changed the World, is generously sponsored by Ivan Kaufman. Rabbi Soloveitchik's podcasts and essays on the Book of Genesis are sponsored by Brad Forney and the BCF Group. This week's episode is generously sponsored by David Mevorach.
Rembrandt's most Jewish painting is seen by few Jews today. It hangs in Kassel, Germany, depicting one of the last scenes of Jacob's life, a loving grandfather bestowing blessings on the sons of his own son, Joseph. The painting is not only beautiful, it is also an embodiment of Rembrandt's biblical interpretation, providing a prism with which to gain a perspective on our parasha. For more than any other weekly reading, this week's is not only about family, but about the bond between grandparents and grandchildren. Indeed, it provides us with the only scenes of grandparents and grandchildren in the entire Hebrew Bible, and it begins and ends with such scenes, thereby bracketing all we read within. Rembrandt's unique way of seeing a story will allow us to understand how this familial bond is also spiritual and political, lying at the very heart of Jewish national existence. As our reading begins, Joseph, the vizier of Egypt, is summoned to his sick father's bed, bringing with him his own children. At this point, they are described in terms of age. Vayikach eshnei vanav imo es Menashe ve'es Ephraim. And he, Joseph, took his two sons with him, Menashe and Ephraim. Jacob implores his son Joseph to swear that he, the patriarch, will be born to his familial burial plot in Canaan following his passing. After Joseph so swears, Jacob then turns to the sons of Joseph, explaining that eventually in the Holy Land, each would be considered a tribe unto himself, receiving his own portion of land. Joseph, through his children, will suddenly become two tribes. Jacob puts it this way, Ephraim and Menashe will be to me as Reuben and Simon. We must note that Jacob has suddenly switched the names of his grandchildren, giving precedence to the younger, Ephraim. Jacob then goes on to bemoan the fact that Joseph's mother, Rachel, had died mid-journey and had been buried on the side of the road rather than in the familial plot. Now, he explains, tribal portions will be accorded to Joseph's children as if they were Jacob's own. This means, as some commentators understand, that the very land of Israel will proclaim Jacob's love for Rachel. Then the grandfather turns to his grandchildren, and the scene depicted by Rembrandt unfolds. Jacob says, "Bring them to me that I may bless them." As Menashe and Ephraim are brought before their grandfather, the wizened Jacob not only places his hands on their heads to bless them, he also implies that there are national implications to this blessing. Forever, Jacob insists, the moment will be modeled in the Israelite future, so that Jewish fathers will say to their own sons, Yisimcha Elohim ke'Ephraim v'chi-Menashe, may God make you as Ephraim and as Menashe. And thus so many fathers use these same words as they bestow blessings today. This may seem initially odd. Why does Jacob select these two boys as role models? What do we even know about them? Why not bless boys in the future that they imitate Moses or Abraham? The answer begins with another important element in the story. Jacob, in his wording, deliberately places the younger child, Ephraim, first, and in reflection of Ephraim's elevation, the grandfather's right hand is placed on the younger grandson's head. Joseph immediately protests, saying, Lo chein avi, not so, my father. We instinctively understand Joseph's shock. After all, so much of his own suffering was the result of the elevation of a younger child ahead of senior siblings. But Jacob responds, I know, my son, I know. He too will be a people and will also be great. However, his younger brother will be greater than he. Ephraim, the ancestor of Joshua, will be second only to Judah in tribal political importance, and his greatness cannot be denied, even as Menashe's own potential is celebrated and sanctified. It is this that Rembrandt seeks to emphasize. Ephraim, the blonde child in the painting, probably modeled on the artist's own son, is elevated by receiving Jacob's right hand, a sign of the profound potential within him. But Rembrandt wants to show that Jacob also highlights how Menashe is cherished, dedicated, sanctified, and loved, and therefore he has Jacob's hand not, as in the text, placed on top of the head, but rather caressing Menashe's face. The story reflects both recognition of particular potential and an embrace of each child. Interestingly, there seems to have been a tradition among some Jews to bless even a single child by using only one hand, as Jacob placed a single hand on each child before him. Thus we have Moritz Oppenheim's Der Segen des Rabbi, the Rabbi's Blessing, where the artist depicts his own rabbi in the town of Hanau, Tobias Sonnheimer, blessing his grandchild, as Jacob blessed his own grandchildren. This rabbinic grandfather thus recalled the original grandfather in Egypt, using one hand to highlight how Jacob guided each hand separately to each child uniquely, reminding us that the tale of Jacob and his grandchildren is about drawing out and dedicating the potential of every child. For Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, this is the reason Jacob designates his grandchildren as role models for future blessings. Every child is different, and Menashe and Ephraim were different from one another. But each grew up to devote his respective talents to the service of God and his people. And that ultimately is what we wish from future generations. The covenantal unity of the scene is meant to be contrasted with previous scriptural stories. The entire saga of Jacob's trouble-ridden life is linked to the elevating and blessing of one child to the exclusion of the other. It began with Jacob's deception of his father, thereby ensuring that the blessings intended for Esau would be bestowed upon him instead. As I argued in our discussion of Toledot, I believe Jacob's actions, taken at the insistence of Rebekah, to have been necessary. But what ended up happening was tragic nevertheless. It turned brother against brother and ensured that Jacob would never truly be with his parents again. Then later, within his own family, Jacob's explicit favoritism for Joseph inspired the enmity of other children. Here, in Egypt, Jacob informs Joseph that as part of a family that will form and father a people, they must find a way to recognize greatness, while at the same time sanctifying and dedicating the talents of each person. Thus, Jacob's blessing his grandchildren together, side by side, is meant to be contrasted with all that has preceded it. After an entire biblical book of Genesis, replete from beginning to end, from Cain and Abel to Joseph and his brothers, with stories of sibling rivalry, after story upon story of havoc wreaked upon family life by envy among brothers, here, brothers are suddenly united in blessing, without denying the uniqueness of each. We can therefore see how this story sets the stage for what is to follow. All of Jacob's children gather around his deathbed. Some are praised, some are criticized, but the potential and destiny of each is described, and all are covenantally connected. There is no Ishmael or Esau that is set apart. And it is this, as Jacob concludes his last words, that Scripture seeks to emphasize. We are told, "All these were the tribes of Israel, 12 in all, and this is what their father spoke to them as he blessed them. Each according to his blessing were they blessed." At this moment, in other words, every son of Jacob finds a future role. As Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch puts it, quote, "When the sons of Yaakov gathered to hear their father's blessing, and he visualized in them the future tribes of Israel, he saw not only Kohanim and teachers of the law," and Rabbi Hirsch adds, "standing before his eyes was the whole nation with all its manifold characteristics and diverse ways of development." End quote. This, as Rabbi Hirsch notes, is fundamentally different from the story of Jacob's own brother, who was denied a future in Israel's covenant. It is all the more striking, then, that Rembrandt, in depicting Ephraim and Menashe, seeks to contrast the scene with what occurred with Jacob and Esau. Rembrandt, perhaps inspired by Jewish texts, places Joseph's wife, Osnath, in the tale as she watches blessings bestowed on her children. This establishes a link to an earlier story where a mother and father were involved in blessings bestowed on children. But Osnath, in contrast to Rebekah, did not need to deceive Jacob, as Isaac was himself deceived. Here, both children are blessed. As Simon Schama writes, quote, "Rembrandt, with his instinctive love of the interweavings and cross-stitchings among different but related scriptures, has included Osnath as a deliberate reminder of an earlier story related in Genesis 27, when the blind Isaac is deceived by Rebekah into supposing that he was bestowing his blessings on his older son Esau." So Schama writes, and he notes something else that is striking. Quote, "Rembrandt has given the dying Jacob a shawl of animal skin wrapped around his neck and falling down his back as a further reminder of the earlier story." End quote. Rembrandt thus reminds us of Jacob placing goat skin on himself to trick Isaac, and thereby highlights here with Jacob's grandchildren the unusual unity in the Abrahamic family that has not existed until this point. For us, as the war in Israel goes on, and as our sense of Jewish unity still stands at this moment as a marked contrast to the fractiousness that existed only mere months ago, we can suddenly understand why Jacob selects Ephraim and Menashe as models of blessing for the national future. Together at Jacob's bed, They embody a people in which different talents are welcome, but in which greatness is recognized without unity being disturbed, without the division that marked Abraham's family throughout the rest of this biblical book. But there is another reason why we, as members of a people, would bless our children by remembering Ephraim and Manasseh. And it lies in the fact that this is one of only two scenes in all of Scripture where we see a bond that transcends more than one generation, where grandfather and grandchildren are joined. The moment thus captures the transmission of Israelite identity beyond one generation, and it therefore takes on national importance. It is noteworthy that the Jewish people in the Bible are named not after the patriarchs Abraham or Isaac, but rather, and only, after the third of the patriarchs, whose two names became synonymous with the nation that descended from him, Jacob and Israel. In discussing this aspect of Jewish identity, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik points out the fact that Jacob is also the patriarch commonly referred to by the Midrash as Zakein, the elder, despite the fact that, quote-unquote, Abraham and Isaac lived longer. It is Jacob, Rabbi Soloveitchik explained, who is, for Jewish tradition, the archetypal biblical grandfather. Abraham and Isaac are never shown interacting with their grandchildren. It is Jacob, rather than those who came before him, who emerges as the ultimate embodiment of immortality and continuity. Jacob, Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, quote, leapt over the gulf of generations and transmitted the great Mesorah, or tradition, of Abraham directly to Ephraim and Manasseh. Despite the discrepancy of years, the Zakein, carrier of the old tradition, succeeded. How appropriate, therefore, that our people is called Israel or Jacob, for it was he who created the Jewish community which ensures Jewish continuity. So Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, the links between generations lies at the heart of our national identity. That this differentiates Israel from Egypt can be discerned in what follows in our reading. Joseph requests that he journey to Canaan to bury his father. At Pharaoh's insistence, Joseph's family is accompanied by a royal retinue, so much so that the local Canaanites mistake the funeral for an Egyptian one. We are told in the Torah that the Canaanites said, it is a great mourning unto Egypt. These Egyptians, in other words, intruded on the Israelite nature of the event. It would seem that Pharaoh sent them in order to ensure that Joseph came back to court. We can therefore understand another odd aspect of the funeral. Whereas a multitude of Egyptians journeyed to Canaan, certain Israelites stayed behind. We are told, Rak tapam vitzonam uvkaram azvu be'aretz Goshen. Only their children and flocks and cattle were left in the land of Goshen. Meaning, the young Israelite grandchildren were denied the ability to join the funeral procession to mark a covenantal moment in Hebron at the cave of Machpelah. The funeral was organized by the order of Pharaoh, and it was therefore in many ways an Egyptian affair. But years later, another Israelite stood before Pharaoh and declared that when next the chosen people departed Egypt, this time for good, it would not be as before. This time, generations would join. We are told in Exodus, and Moses said, with our old and with our young will we go, with our sons and daughters, with our flocks and cattle will we go, for it is a festival of the Lord for us. Israelites, in other words, cannot mark covenantal moments without joining generations. We are now better able to understand why Jews bless members of the next generation by praying that they imitate Ephraim and Manasseh. What they mean is that these children should embody an ability to connect with generations before our own, that they have a relationship with Jacob, just as Ephraim and Manasseh connected with a patriarch that preceded them by so many years. The moral and political health of a society lies in its ability to connect with its past. Abraham Lincoln, as a young man, famously worried whether the lessons of the Revolution would be remembered when those who were there passed away. Lincoln said, speaking of the Revolution, the consequence was that of those scenes in the form of a husband, a father, a son, or brother, a living history was to be found in every family. A history bearing the indubitable testimonies of its own authenticity, in the limbs mangled, in the scars of wounds received, in the midst of the very scenes related, a history too that could be read and understood alike by all, the wise and the ignorant, the learned and the unlearned. But those histories are gone. They can be read no more forever. They were a fortress of strength, but what invading foemen could never do, the silent artillery of time has done, the leveling of its walls, they are gone. So Lincoln reflected. For America to endure, Lincoln argued, it must be able to connect with the founding generation even when only the grandchildren of that generation still live. It is this ability to bridge generations that lies at the heart of Jewish endurance. In a famous Talmudic tale, Rabbi Akiva, witnessing the destruction of Jerusalem, predicted the Jewish return by citing Zechariah. There shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age. And the streets shall be full of boys and girls playing the streets thereof. There were so many prophetic predictions that Rabbi Akiva could have cited, but the one he chose was so seemingly simple and yet sublime. That one day, grandparents and grandchildren will sit together in the streets of Yerushalayim, as Jacob sat with his grandchildren. The connection of Jewish generations ultimately outlasted Rome, as it has every other empire that followed. We can therefore appreciate how the Torah portion that began with one of the only two scenes in the Hebrew Bible of grandparents with grandchildren concludes with the other one, describing the joy that Joseph experienced from his family. We are told, "And Joseph saw from Ephraim a third generation, and also Machir the son of Menasseh grew up on Joseph's knees." Genesis comes to a close, highlighting the bond between generations, as if to suggest that this bond will allow Israel to endure until the Exodus occurs. It is a strange fact of history that many of Rembrandt's biblical paintings that were inspired by his encounters with Jews now hang in Germany. This means that today, few Jews see this scene that is so vividly reenacted by Jewish parents in their own homes. But I like to think that this painting may have been seen by Kassel's most famous Jew, Franz Rosenzweig, who, in the first part of the 20th century, had planned to convert to Christianity, and then, on a whim, attended a Yom Kippur service. He suddenly seemed to have heard his ancestors calling out to him in Kol Nidre. Connecting with the spirit of generations that had lived before, he returned to Judaism and went on to write The Star of Redemption, one of the most important modern works of Jewish thought. It is a nation that joins generations that comes into being as Genesis comes to a close, and it is such a nation that will endure forever. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, signing off.